Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. Today we're going to explore how encouraging more people to follow healthier diets can help minimize the environmental impact of food production. University of Minnesota and Oxford University. I'll explain that in detail and why that's important for all of us. Because you can have five very good healthy outcomes and five aspects of environmental control, meaning what we choose to eat and how it impacts the environment does make a difference, especially when more and more of us are doing it. Also today, I'm going to share what I thought was a very provocative commentary, Beyond Postmodern, the Neoliberal Roots of Woke Cancel Culture, published in Aereo by Martin Stern. And we asked Martin how would he like to have, his background. And he simply said, quote, Marty Stern is an academic professional with interests in natural science, anthropology, and political economy. And he is a big believer of localism, vernacular architecture, and letting X equal X. He's a heavyweight, as you will see. Also today, a few thoughts from Chris Hedges on American Requiem. And that's from Sheer Post, S-C-H-E-E-R, Post. I was up during the evening writing because I believe that we are not looking at the real solutions because we're not understanding the real problems. We're looking at a problem from the current end-stage symptom and not at the underlying cause. So it doesn't matter who's in office on one level because the politics of power are inbred in both the Democratic and Republican Party. We've seen that between Clinton and George Bush, between Obama and Trump. It doesn't matter. You and I don't benefit. The environment doesn't improve. World peace doesn't occur. Asking for forgiveness and helping to rebuild the thousands of communities around the world that we've negatively impacted with our military-industrial complex hegemonic philosophy doesn't change. Nothing changes for the better because of who's in office, who's in power. I think we have to come to that understanding, which means we have to go beyond emotion and beyond intellect to innate wisdom. In fact, it was Richard Gale, my producer, we had a long conversation about bringing on guests over the next 3 weeks who are profound thinkers, people who get back to what we used to learn. In fact, those of us who are baby boomers, we were the last generation to go to college and have classes on wisdom, not just knowledge enhancement. And now knowledge enhancement isn't taught, rather power. How to get what you want, when you want it, now. Well, what happened to wisdom that's guided people throughout all the millennia? It's gone. So we're going to talk about that. I'll talk about that somewhat on today's program. Also, before we get started, I just want to let you know, for those of you who said, well, you can't take hydroxychloroquine because it causes irregular heart rhythms, AFib. Not true. This is just today from the American College of Rheumatology. Quote, hydroxychloroquine not linked to a longer heart rhythm intervals in rheumatoid arthritis or lupus patients. And this was just presented this week in Atlanta at the American College of Rheumatology's annual meeting. But remember, who said that it was bad to take? Two articles. And from those two articles, four additional ones were written. The two big ones, one published in The Lancet, one published in New England Journal of Medicine, had to be retracted. They were fraudulent articles. And also, when did people get hurt when they take hydroxychloroquine? Well, when they're in intensive care in ICU units and they're being given ventilation, they're at the end of their life, and then they were giving up to 9,000 milligrams? Of course they died. So they use that cherry-picked information instead of looking at the 55 peer-reviewed studies that show that this very inexpensive, non-patented, it's off-patent drug that's been used safely, including with babies, all over Africa. It's one of the reasons that Africans have had less deaths, because they use it regularly. It's not by prescription there, nor was it by prescription in France. You could go in just like a vitamin and buy it. And at 200 to 400 milligrams, for people working in hospitals or those who are in direct contact with sick people, you can take it preventatively. That along with zinc and zithromycin. And all the experts have come forward to say that, and they're immediately attacked by Anthony Fauci's little mob. So today I'm going to give you a little information, insight, and why you should never trust anything that fool has to say about anything. He should be in prison for the rest of his life for crimes against humanity, and I will document that. So just want to put another nail in the coffin of this. Don't take hydroxychloroquine. That's the one drug, if everyone were taking it within the first 7 days at low potency under medical supervision, we could have probably stopped 80% of the deaths, or people going from symptomatic to end stage. So that's a new study. You heard it here. What do you want to bet? You hear it nowhere else in the media. Check for yourself. The American College of Rheumatology, the current issue right now. So we are making progress in some areas. For example, good news, there was a major victory. The federal court smacks down the FDA approval of frankenfish. Quote, the absolute last thing our planet needs right now is another human-created crisis like escaped genetically engineered fish running amok. Good. So now, even though the FDA, a totally corrupt organization, I wouldn't trust anything anyone there says. They're fully controlled and captured by special interest groups. But they approved frankenfish, but a federal court saw the evidence and said no. So that's good news. So once in a while, we do win. And the people leading this was the Earth Justice and Center for Food Safety. They challenged the FDA. And finally, a good victory there. So good news. Also some good news, finally, out of India. I'll go to the latest on health now, show you why this one study where we should eat healthier diets. A study that was recently carried out by researchers from the University of Minnesota and in England at Oxford University revealed that foods that have the most positive health outcomes tend to have the lowest environmental impact, while foods associated with disease, likely highly processed foods and animal proteins, factory farming, and all that runoff from factory farms can be very harmful to the environment. Researchers made this determination by looking at how consumption of 15 food groups is associated with 5 health outcomes and 5 aspects of environmental degradation. Now, the specific foods that were associated with better health, fruits, vegetables, nuts, legumes, beans, olive oil, olives, and whole grain cereals like brown rice, quinoa, millet, had the lowest impact on the environment. That's good. Red meat, both processed and unprocessed, had the most negative impact on the environment and also happened to be the unhealthiest. Al Gore, you getting this message? Al, for a second, could you just suspend your ego and this massive need to make billions of dollars, which your hedge fund has made, and actually go vegan and promote it? Arnold Schwarzenegger did. James Cameron and his wife did. Good for them. And they're now, James Cameron and his wife have a school for vegans. And so the word is getting out, and that's good. And by the way, this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. That's our most respected scientific journal. And it was also reconfirmed at Harvard's School of Public Health. So when you look at the fact that commercial food production makes up 30% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, with the livestock sector representing half of these emissions, it also takes up around 40% of the global land and is the biggest factor threatening species with extinction. For example, 90% of all the fish caught in the world is not eaten by humans. It goes to livestock. But livestock shouldn't be eating fish. Well, they do. That's how it works. 37 scientists across 16 countries maintains that reducing global consumption of red meat and sugar by 50% while doubling consumption of vegetables, fruits, legumes, and nuts is needed to create a planetary healthy diet. I fully agree. And that's what we want. And by the way, I've mentioned for decades that you have two brains, one in your skull, cranium, and one in your gut. That's just been confirmed again by Cambridge University. Now, we know that the brain is uniquely protected against invading bacteria and viruses, but its defense mechanism has long remained a mystery. Now, a study in mice confirmed in humans has shown that the brain has a surprising ally in its protection, the gut. The brain is arguably the most important organ in the body, as it controls most other body systems, enables reasoning and intelligence and emotion, unless, of course, you voted for Trump or Biden. We got to find the brain down in the rectum. Humans have evolved a variety of protective measures to prevent physical damage to the brain. For example, it sits in a solid bony case, that's your skull, and it's wrapped in three layers of watertight tissue known as the meninges. But what has been less clear is how the body defends the brain from infection. Elsewhere in the body, if bacteria or viruses enter the bloodstream, our immune system kicks in with immune cells and antibodies that target and eliminate the invader. However, the protection in the brain is a form of impermeable barrier preventing these immune cells from entering the brain. But research just published in Nature magazine, led by a team from the University of Cambridge and the National Institutes of Health in USA, have found that the meninges are home to immune cells known as plasma cells, which secrete antibodies. And these cells are specifically positioned next to the large blood vessels running within the membrane, allowing them to secrete their antibody guards to defend the perimeter of the brain. And when the researchers looked at the specific type of antibodies produced by these cells, they got a surprise. The antibody they observed is normally found in the intestine, in your gut. The plasma cells are derived from a particular type of immune cell known as B cell, and every B cell has an antibody on its surface that is unique to that cell. If an antigen, that's the part of the bacterium or virus that triggers an immune response, binds to that surface antibody, the B cell becomes activated. It will divide to make new offspring and also recognize that same antigen. So that's all important. It means that, sure enough, eat good foods, eat probiotic foods like yogurt or sauerkraut or miso, tempeh, because then you're doing a lot of good. And finally, from the University of South Bohemia, which is in the Czech Republic, health status is determined by a balance of oxidants and antioxidants, which protects healthy cells against the threat of internal and external risk factors. Well, your number one antioxidant is vitamin C, or ascorbic acid. It's fundamental. And so new research has determined that vitamin C can help protect healthy cells during cancer treatment. Now, I've advocated this for a long time. I was working with oncologists that they would give a specific type of chemotherapy at lower doses, and I was giving them a protocol for high-dose vitamin C. As a result, they didn't lose their hair. Their immune system was strong. It wasn't wiped out because of the chemotherapy, and they were able to deal with the cancer. So that's all good. That's the latest on health and healing. We are 20 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break, and when we come back from the break, I'm going to play for someone that I was counseling this morning who said they have no meaning left in life, that they don't know what to live for. So just sit watching television all day, vegetating, stressed with extreme anxiety. And I said, okay, I'm going to play a short clip of someone that I have an enormous amount of respect for, Viktor Frankl, Dr. Viktor Frankl, 5-year-old kid, was in the concentration camps, survived, because he said it was those who had a purpose and meaning greater than the pain and deprivation they were suffering from who were most likely to survive. Coming back with Professor Viktor Frankl and just a moment. Please stay with us.
The truth is that as the struggle for survival has subsided, the question has emerged, survival for what? Even more people today have the means to live, but no meaning to live for. These are the words of Viktor Frankl, a 20th century Viennese psychiatrist, most famous for his book Man's Search for Meaning. In that book, Frankl details his time spent as a Nazi concentration camp prisoner, and reflects on how one can find meaning in life, even in the harshest of conditions. Frankl, whose interest in the topic of life's meaning began as a teenager, came to the realization that while ever more people in Western nations were living lives of material comfort, all too many lived in a detrimental psychological state he called the existential vacuum, as he explained. The existential vacuum is a widespread phenomenon of the 20th century. This is understandable. It may be due to a twofold loss which man has had to undergo since he became a truly human being. At the beginning of human history, man lost some of the basic animal instincts in which an animal's behavior is embedded and by which it is secured. In addition to this, however, man has suffered another loss in his more recent development, inasmuch as the traditions which buttressed his behavior are now rapidly diminishing. No instinct tells him what he has to do, and no tradition tells him what he ought to do. Sometimes, he does not even know what he wishes to do. Instead, he either wishes to do what other people do, conformism, or he does what other people wish him to do, totalitarianism. The preponderance of people living lives absent of meaning led to the emergence of what Frankl called the mass neurotic triad. This was a term he coined to describe the three most common symptoms associated with lives lived in the existential vacuum, namely depression, aggression, and addiction. To help counter the dire effects that accompany a life without meaning, Frankl founded a school of psychiatry called logotherapy, which in Frankl's words, considers man as a being whose main concern consists of fulfilling a meaning and in actualizing values, rather than in the mere gratification and satisfaction of drives and instincts. In the remainder of this video, we will outline some of the key insights of logotherapy, insights Frankl believed could greatly assist one in living a more fulfilling life. A key tenet of logotherapy is that the pursuit of meaning, or what Frankl sometimes referred to as the will to meaning, is the primary motivational factor in humans. This can be contrasted to other schools of psychiatry which maintain that the pursuit of pleasure or the will to power are the primary factors. According to Frankl, it is when individuals fail to find meaning in their lives that they turn to the dogged pursuit of pleasure or power, in the false belief that so doing will fill the void that an absence of meaning has left in them. For those who decide to pursue a more meaningful existence, Frankl emphasized that doing so did not mean searching for the ultimate meaning of life, as he put it. This ultimate meaning necessarily exceeds and surpasses the finite intellectual capacities of man. What is demanded of man is not, as some existential philosophers teach, to endure the meaninglessness of life, but rather to bear his incapacity to grasp its unconditional meaningfulness in rational terms. While the ultimate meaning of life is unknowable, Frankl held that each person had the opportunity to realize meaning in their life at a personal level, and so doing would greatly improve the quality of their life. It should be noted that Frankl did not believe that individuals created such meaning. Rather, he believed it was discovered and was present in every living moment, whether one was aware of it or not, as he put it. I am convinced that in the final analysis, there is no situation that does not contain within it the seed of a meaning. In order to discover and realize these personal seeds of meaning, Frankl suggested that for most people a change of attitude is required. We need to stop asking about the meaning of life, and instead to think of ourselves as those who are being questioned by life, daily and hourly. Our answer must consist not in talk and meditation, but in right action and right conduct. Life ultimately means the responsibility to find the right answers to its problems, and to fulfill the tasks which it constantly sets for each individual. Frankl stressed that as unique individuals, meaning will present itself in different ways to each person. Each of us face different situations in our lives, some of which are more and some of which are less under our control and influence. Frankl's belief was that no matter what fate brought, if one took appropriate action and adopted the right attitude to the situation, a meaningful life could be realized. In a passage in Man's Search for Meaning, Frankl nicely distinguished how actualizing personal meaning differs from the search for abstract answers to life's meaning. To put the question of the meaning of life in general terms would be comparable to the question posed to a chess champion. Tell me, master, what is the best move in the world? There simply is no such thing as the best or even a good move apart from a particular situation in a game and the particular personality of one's opponent. The same holds for human existence. One should not search for an abstract meaning of life. Everyone has his own specific vocation or mission in life to carry out, a concrete assignment which demands fulfillment. As Frankl notes, often the best way to live a life rich with meaning is to find one's unique vocation. Nothing contributes more to the feeling of a meaningless existence than boredom, and nothing counters feelings of boredom better than having a specific mission to carry out in one's life. In this respect, Frankl was fond of quoting Nietzsche's famous passage that "he who has a why to live for can bear almost any how." Finding one's why was, according to Frankl, the best way to live a meaningful and therefore fulfilling life. However, for some, adopting a vocation and striving to achieve the goals associated with it is beyond their reach. Instead, some people face situations which they have little control over, situations which can cause immense suffering, such as being diagnosed with a terminal illness or, in Frankl's case, being imprisoned in a concentration camp. But even in such situations, as Frankl discovered firsthand, one has the opportunity to find meaning. And we will conclude this video with a passage which reflects this important belief of Frankl's. We must never forget that we may also find meaning in life even when confronted with a hopeless situation, when facing a fate that cannot be changed. For what then matters is to bear witness to the uniquely human potential at its best, which is to transform a personal tragedy into a triumph, to turn one's predicament into a human achievement. When we are no longer able to change a situation, we are challenged to change ourselves.
Now put this into context with COVID having destroyed so many lives that were being lived authentically and with decency and with a sense of purpose, your family, raising your children, mastering your career, being a good neighbor, and being able to do things that gave you pleasure at the low end of the hedonic scale, things that gave you joy, like gardening, or going to the opera, or going to concerts, or writing, creating. These are things that allow us each day to think there's something else today that I could do that allows this day to have meaning. But when you're depressed, or you're suffering from acute anxiety, and you're in a isolated environment, and what you had you no longer have, or losing a grip on it, then you have to reassess, if I have to travel far in life, if you're a young person, then use the Chinese proverb, then travel light. This is now the time that we have to reassess the difference between a standard of living, that's what we've been living through in this vulture capitalist society for the last 50 years, and versus living for a quality of life, which means more minimalism. The less you have, the more freedom you have. The more you have, the less freedom you have, because you have more responsibility for everything you possess. And that's part of what makes rich people or wealthy people so encumbered. They feel that now they have to use their wealth to prove people that they have a value. And the value is in what they can possess, what they can buy. And then a whole legion of people begin to support that. The marketing people, the salespeople, the designers. So it's no longer good enough just to have a house. You have to house like no one else has a house and spend outrageous amounts of money, far beyond what it's valued at. In fact, almost everything that we end up buying, it's overpriced. And that's because we're more interested in knowing if you're wealthy or the professional class, at least, or the millionaire class. Mind you, we're dealing with 25% of the population who are wealthy. 25%, not 1%, 25%. And that's why for them, life will not change a whole lot. They'll go through depressions just like anyone else and ups and downs, especially when the things they thought were so important are radically changed, when they have to give up a career and or choose to, and now what takes its place. And they haven't prepared for the next venture in their life, the next chapter in their life. They turn the page and there's an empty page there. They've been living through memorizing and having one else memorize the page they were living in, their story. Now they got to write a new story. So you see, crisis brings us to an opportunity to write a new chapter, a new sense of perception about ourselves, our crisis, and how we're going to become stronger because of it. Just something to think about. That said, now that the election is officially over, though we are still waiting to see who wins, from my perspective, it doesn't matter who wins, because the people who won before the election and have won before the last 50 years of elections have won once again. The rich and powerful. Who loses? The working class, the minorities, and the poor. That's because capitalism, as we know it today, has been the anchor to the social contract. As long as you worked hard, or as long as you did what you were trained to do, then in time you would benefit. Maybe piecemeal, maybe incrementally, but you would benefit. The value of your house would go up, the value of your savings would increase, and your knowledge would increase. So everything was on a trajectory up. Nobody thought, well, what happens on a finite planet with finite resources if you overuse these, overexploit them? Nobody gave a second thought. Nobody cared, because everybody was making money from it. Back in the late 1960s, I interviewed some people who worked for a munitions factory. They made these personal landmines, which America was one of the only, I think, two or three countries in the world that didn't sign a treaty to stop manufacturing and implementing these personal landmines, which are meant to blow off people's legs and kill them. And they do to this day, about 10,000 per year. We've never gone back out there and done the right thing and gone into Cambodia and Laos and Vietnam and other countries, and Angola, etc., and remove them. But ask a person that's making a living, and a good living, just by working the production in, and they don't want to give that up. Now ask a person making a lot more money in the management administrative end, they don't want to give that money up. In fact, nobody wants to give up the money. That's true of working for Monsanto or any DuPont or any of these other multinational corporations, or working for Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola or Burger King or NBC, ABC. They're all in it for the money, fame, and standard of living. Okay, that's what we've been living on. But now we have hundreds of trillions of dollars in debt in the United States. I've gone through these figures multiple times, and they're real. And therefore, we're bankrupt. Well, we're bankrupt as a nation. We're bankrupt at state level, at the city levels. If every city in America, if every state in America, and if the federal government had to either pay off all of its bills currently or go broke, you would have very few places left in America that were not broke. In fact, that's also true for a lot of very wealthy people. Yeah, they make a lot of money, and they spend everything they make. They don't have any, they have no back, a fallback position. In fact, how much did they spend in this election? The closest figures I can determine are $1.5 billion, $1.5 billion for Biden, and $1.5 billion for Trump, about the same. Think of it. That's $3 billion spent on a presidential election. In one of the Senate races, it was over $100 million. So what does this mean? According to Chris Hedges, this means that America is a failed state. Quote, the people always lose. It does not matter who sits in the White House, according to Chris Hedges. And indeed, I would agree with that. There are many actors that killed America's open society. The corporate oligarchs, right at the top, yes. Do they ever ask you for your opinion? No. Me? No. Do we have solutions? You bet. But they don't care about our solutions. No, they own the electoral process. They own the courts. They own the media. They own the lobbyists. They own the legislators. They own the think tanks. They own everything that's of value, which means that all the rest of us have to live at different levels of impoverishment. Also, they can brag about how many zeros they added to their net worth. The military-industrial complex is the largest expenditure that we have from our tax dollars, and that's about $1.5 trillion. $1.5 trillion. Of course, the medical industrial complex is the number one expense, but they won't touch that. Left or right, the new Democrats or the social Democrats do not want to take the profit, excessive profits, out of the medical system. They just want more people to be insured. But that's stupid, because what if your existing medical system is also the most lethal in the world? That's not possible. That's impossible. with nearly 800,000, more or less, physicians and all the nurses, hospitals, the science labs, MIT, Harvard, Stanford, all these great places bringing out all these great innovations and minds? Yes. But what is the reality? Every year, more Americans are killed by medicine than any disease. We wrote a book on it. We wrote a scientific paper on it called Death by Medicine. It took us 5 years using their figures that has never been refuted. In fact, it's been used now all over the place. So wouldn't it make sense, instead of simply saying our number one goal is to see that everyone is insured, to say that every American has the right to have the best health care delivery system, including preventative systems, so they don't get sick to begin with, and then have the best of alternative medicine and the best of orthodox medicine, but make sure that anything within orthodox medicine that is commonly used, like synthetic hormone replacement therapy for women, that doesn't work and is dangerous and causes 13% adverse effects, including heart attacks and stroke, that is removed from the equation. That would be reasonable, but there's nothing reasonable when it comes to power and money. So that's where we're at. Think of the CEOs. They're making bonuses and compensation packages into tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of dollars. And they're the ones who shipped your jobs overseas and left our cities in ruins and our workers in misery and despair without sustainable income. And according to Chris Hedges, quote, the fossil fuel industry that made war on science and chose profits over the looming extinction of the human species. The press that turned news into mindless entertainment and partisan cheerleading, the intellectuals who retreated into the universities to preach the moral absolutism of identity politics and multiculturalism while turning their backs on the economic warfare being waged on the working class and the unrelenting assault on civil liberties, and of course the feckless, hypocritical liberal class that does nothing but talk, 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 end quote. Chris Hedges. If there's one group, according to Chris, that deserves our deepest contempt, it is the liberal elites, those who posture at the moral arches as the arbiters of society while abandoning every value that purportedly holds the moment they become inconvenient. The liberal class, once again, served as pathetic cheerleaders and censors for a candidate in a political party that in Europe would be considered on the far right, even while liberals were being ridiculed and dismissed by Biden and the Democratic Party hierarchy, which bizarrely invested its political energy in appealing to Republican neocons. Liberals were busy marginalizing journalists, including Glenn Greenwald, Matt Taibbi, who called out Biden and the Democrats. The liberals, whether at The Intercept or The New York Times, ignored or discredited information that could hurt the Democratic Party, including the revelations on Hunter Biden's laptop. It was a stunning display of craven careerism and self-loathing. But that's what we become. So the Democrats and their liberal apologists are the election of those who are oblivious to the profound personal and economic despair sweeping this country. They stand for nothing. They fight for nothing. Restoring the rule of law, universal health care, banning fracking, the new Green Deal, the protection of civil liberties, the building of unions, the preservation and expansion of social welfare programs, a moratorium on evictions and foreclosures, the forgiveness of student debt, stiff environmental controls, a government jobs program and guaranteed income, financial regulation, opposition to endless war and military adventurism were once again completely forgotten. You heard no one discuss that. So the surrender of the liberal elite to despotism and creates a power vacuum that speculators, war profiteers, and gangsters and killers, often led by charismatic demagogues, fill. It opens the door to fascist movements that rise in prominence by ridiculing and taunting the absurdities of the liberal class and the values they are grounded in truth. Once the liberal class ceases to function, it opens a Pandora's box of evils that are impossible to contain. The disease of Trumpism, with or without Trump, is, as the election illustrated, deeply embedded in the body politic. So what can we do about all this? Simple. We can start to break away and disconnect and get off the political grid, the economic grid, the educational grid, and most importantly, start to reconnect with values based upon all life matters. All life is sacred. The environmental life, life of animals, therefore you couldn't kill them and eat them. The life of people, therefore you couldn't denigrate them. You would treat them with love and respect, unless they chose not to be treated by all. Everyone's invited to my table. I've said that my entire career. A person may not want to be at my table, but there's no one excluded. You look for the spiritual. Start with what is most foundational and fundamental and primal. We're here to serve each other, not to dominate. So as long as you believe in a system that dominates you, in a police force that dominates you, in a food system that corrupts your body and poisons it, in an environment that exploits every resource for profit, and not to allow the natural beauty and the sanctity of that natural environment to exist, then one day we have global warming, and one day we have acidification of the oceans, and one day we have the melting of Mount Kilimanjaro, which has just happened in Africa, that Hemingway and others thought would never happen. One day we have methane percolating out of the tundra in the boreal forest regions and around the Arctic. One day we have the calving of massive amounts of ice coming off Antarctica, amounts never before thought could happen are happening. One day we have fires in Greenland. One day we have a 100-degree day in the winter in Siberia. One day we have storms that decimate in a matter of hours 10 million acres of farmland in Kansas and Missouri. One day we have water, 21 trillion gallons, pouring down in the Houston area, creating 5 foot of flooding. One day we have the aquifer system near Hialeah and in the east coast of right around Boca, little below Boca, Fort Lauderdale, Miami. And now it's being invaded by the seawater. It's been breached, so the water won't be drinkable in Miami and that whole area. One day, 95% of all species are gone. One day, our soil is as dry and being swept as it was back in the 1930s in John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. One day, we have 80 million Americans who are internal environmental refugees. They can't live in California, Oregon. They can't live in Washington State. They can't live in Florida, South Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama. One day, you can't live in New Orleans because it's flooded. One day, the trees that once were blooming in the northern latitudes, Wisconsin and Michigan, one day those have dried, and beetles infested, and hundreds of millions of trees died, which leads to fires. One day we have not just 66 million hungry men, women, and children in America, we have 100 million hungry and 200 million out of work. One day we no longer have cities operating as we have historically. Instead, you have green zones where the rich and powerful can still maintain their standard of living and everyone else lives in Mad Maxvilles. That day is now. It's coming now. You'll see all this in the next 2 years. But I want to share something else as well, something I believe has to be dealt with, and that is trying to understand what is happening. And I want to share some of the thoughts of Marty Stern. A number of writers on the left and center left have recently expressed alarm at cancel culture. You've heard me talk about it repeatedly on the show. This suddenly you're a professor like Mark Crispin Miller is going to be on the show next week, and a tenured professor talking about propaganda, one of the brightest minds in academia and one of the most fearless. and no complaints from his students, but some outside agitator, and suddenly there's petitions to get him canceled, get him fired, without thinking, what has this person contributed? So you have a difference of opinion on something he said? Then talk it out. No, that's not how cancel culture works. In some respects, their concerns match those of conservatives who've railed against campus deplatforming, and I've said this all along. For those of us who grew up liberal, or in my case, ultra-liberal, defending causes that other liberals wouldn't touch, because most liberals were pro-vaccine and pro-big pharma, they didn't concern the difference between organic and non-organic, and a lot of other things like that. You had no problem lecturing on college campuses, but if you were conservative, you did. Now it's almost impossible, and I don't want to see a college campus reject someone just because they hold conservative values. I don't want it to be a safe place for those of us who hold progressive values to feel comfortable in talking about whatever we want, and yet another group of people, simply because of how they look at life and their own political perspectives, are suddenly deemed no longer of value as a human being, the enemy, the other, someone to disparage. Now, this creates a platform where you have compelled speech, censorship, trigger warnings, safe spaces, microaggressions, and victimhood culture that becomes rampant. It begins to metastasize from nothing a few years ago, 10 years ago, to major universities where considered the elites go, where children were raised in a bubble culture, more often than not, from professional parents, doctors, lawyers, engineers, scientists, who didn't have to see the world as it was given an artificial notion of how life is. Everything's perfect. You're perfect. You know, even if you come in 10th in a race, you still get an award, just like the person came in first, because they don't want you to feel bad. So there's no sense of working in a disciplined way and creating something that's uniquely your own moniker. You did this. There's no meritocracy. You just show up, and you're supposed to be rewarded and loved and fed because of that. With these malignancies of student coddling reflecting years of helicopter parenting and depression-induced cognitive distortions serve many on the right as prima facie evidence that political correctness run amok is threatening the cherished liberal values of free inquiry and the tolerance of dissent. And what is it that most of the liberals value? The ability to say what you have to say and allow people to disagree with you or agree, but not to say you can't say it because it will offend me. It doesn't match my perception of reality. Do you know what that's like growing up where even the discussion of fiber in the diet was considered so offensive that the ABC in Chicago network invited me to debate the top person or one of the top people at the American Medical Association, the AMA, to debate the relevance and reality of fiber? And they couldn't accept that fiber was a big deal. And that's when the average American had about 3 grams of fiber in their body. And I was suggesting then 40 grams. Today I'm suggesting 40 to 50 grams. I was right. All the science is right. You need more fiber and all the diseases associated with it. They were wrong. They've always been wrong about everything. And yet because they were the dominant force, they were accepted. So imagine what it's like when every debate you have and hundreds debate because no one else would debate. They were all afraid. They didn't want their careers. They didn't want their names sullied. So I just said, to hell with it. You know, let's get it on. Let's see who's got the most interesting and authentic message. I would always come with science and share it. Never to denigrate the other person. I didn't do that. Never once. And all they could do is denigrate. Well, you're not a medical doctor. Yeah, fool, but I became a PhD. Now try to see who studies the hardest news, the most original thinker between a PhD who has to prove mastery of field or you don't get your damn doctorate. And I have a multi-doctorate disciplinary degree in public health. But you just have to do it rote-wise. Even if rote is wrong, you have to do it. So when you go out in there and start killing patients by not thinking and sticking with protocols that are wrong, then where's that clear and clever mind that says, this is wrong, the patient's not benefiting, let's change? No, because some big hand's going to come down and grab you, say, no, this is the protocol, this is what we, the pharmaceutical industry, are making a profit from, this is what you do. You can't do that with someone like myself or others who are conditioned to learn for themselves. We don't learn in a group. It's one-on-one. In my case, it was 9 members of my doctoral committee, none of them friendly to me, and myself. So get over such big thinking of yourself that you're an expert because of where you went to school. It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. Education is education. When you get your degree, whether you get it from Harvard, you get it from State University of New York at SUNY, you're getting the same equivalency. Now, the teacher may be different, but you can't say one's smarter than the other because they all had to meet the same standards to stay accredited. So we have a cognitive distortion, and this can lead to thinking you're better than who you are and always trying to blame everybody else for the mistakes you've made and trying to ridicule people and demean people and everyone in the field. I'm talking about every holistic dentist like Dr. Amara Gadol, an outstanding dentist, and all the holistic chiropractors like Mitchell Proppen and over in wherever he's at now, Brooklyn or Queens, and all of the holistic cardiologists like Dr. Vanini and the oncologist and the neurologist and all of these doctors, of which there are thousands, all demeaned. They have to stay silent in the closet because our society says the cancel culture will cancel you if you cure a patient, improve a patient, or suggest a treatment regimen that is not in accordance with our accepted therapies. So even if you want to cure the economy like Michael Hudson and other brave and courageous and insightful economists, you can't. If you want to show how farming can be done, Ronnie Cummings, one of the best organic farmers in America, will not be invited into Davos because Davos is only promoting commercial farming. If you want to see how to clean up the river, as no one's ever cleaned up the river like Robert Kennedy Jr. cleaned up the Hudson River with his river project, he did more to clean the river and punish the polluters than anyone in the history of that river. But he's not going to be invited to give his testimony. You see, the people who could show us how to feed a nation growing food locally and dynamically and organically will never be invited. The people who could show us how that a quality of life can be done in a minimalist way without upsetting the environment will never be invited. The people who can show how to have a challenging curriculum that is not for profit, but rather for enhancing the intellectual capacity that allows a student to see the wonder of bridging the old system and compelling yourself to come up with a better system, a better solution. And that's where we thrive when we're given a task that no one's been able to solve and we solve it. And as a result, we, all of us, at every level, who've been right, have never been acknowledged for it. Wikipedia demeans us. The New York Times marginalizes, and the cancel culture then says, well, you're not politically correct. You bet. When I become politically correct, stop listening to me. These people, the prima facie believers, these are the critics. Well, I see the council culture as the predictable outcome of the postmodern takeover of the universities that began mandating diversity and inclusion in the 1980s and now seeks to impose campus culture on wider society. According to Marty Stern, some opponents trace the rise of the postmodern to neo-Marxism or Marxism itself. Some even accuse the U.S. Democratic Party of staffing postmodern Marxist indoctrination campuses. There are elements of truth within all these accusations. As George Packer has recently argued, certain commissars with large followings patrol the precincts of social media and punish thought criminals, most progressive assent without difficulty to the stifling consensus of the moment and the intolerance it breeds, not out of fear, but because they want to be counted on the side of justice. You do realize that Hitler was able to enact laws that made being a Jewish professional illegal and owning a Jewish business, even if it had been there hundreds of years, illegal. So we have to ask ourselves, how many of the laws that society says we must abide by today are ethical and moral and based upon true justice instead of some stupid notion that serves some group against all others? So as we adapt to a pandemic without foreseeable end, these cultural questions matter even more than they do in normal times, as the effects of decisions made during historical crisis tend to persist for generations. So one group of scientists will say the virus, the COVID virus, can easily penetrate any mask that we have. And that would be correct. Does that mean you shouldn't wear masks? No, it doesn't, because there are other germs that you could block, like coughing and sneezing, larger water molecules, therefore justifying it. But to say that anyone who doesn't wear a mask is anti-science or is wants to infect the public and therefore should be punished, that's wrong. The term neoliberalism has become fraught. Some regard it as a pejorative hurled by those opposed to globalized capitalism, while others simply use it as John McWhorton does. But whatever we call it, we've all been immersed in deregulation, privatization, free trade, deficit-driven austerity, and globalized financialization. And that's to our detriment, not to our benefit. And universities were already wounded before postmodernism. Though the university has traditionally been a modernist project, guided by the values of the Enlightenment, it's striking how readily post-structuralist and post-modernist perspectives came to predominate, particularly in the faculties of literature, education, social sciences, and law. So one needn't be a conspiracy theorist or suggest apocalyptic implications to acknowledge that a philosophical ideological shift has occurred within some academic fields and that this is reflected in the general language and culture of universities. And since most university professors consider themselves liberal and postmodernist writers condemn institutional domination over the marginalized, many have assumed that this explains academia's embrace of both politically correct censorship and the prioritizing of group-level equality and inclusion over traditional academic discipline. The extent of postmodern academia's influence on the culture wars is debatable. However, an evidence that professors are drawn to postmodern's supposed neo-Marxism seems equivocal at best. In practice, most postmodernish faculty merely strike radical poses, while the few actual Marxists left warn of damage wrought by postmodernism to the entire academic enterprise. And while some campus radicals in the 1960s went to graduate school and joined the academy, many more did not. So it fell to their more compliant, savvier, younger siblings to become the professors at elite institutions who saw theory and ideals as their path to tenure. Thus, tagging postmodernists as neo-Marxists obscures their far greater influence over mainstream progressives who came of age during a new world order, when liberals began to settle for gestures and symbols in lieu of material outcomes for social instead of income inequality. And I'll finish with this. The role of liberal academics in the adoption of the inclusive administrative policies in the 1990s was probably far less consequential than has usually been assumed. To suggest that university administrators are motivated by fealty to their professors' political ideology, let alone to their intellectual commitments, one must ignore 40 years of the steady nurturing and then neutering of faculty power over institutional policies and priorities. Like employees everywhere, many, perhaps most, professors complain of their administrators' preoccupation with bottom-line realities. How much profit are we making? The funding of public universities prior to the 1970s was comparatively generous, but that business model was dismantled decades ago. The rollbacks of government support for education began during Ronald Reagan's governorship, when he famously argued that the state should not fund intellectual curiosity. Soon after Reagan's 1981 inauguration, new right think tanks advocated slashing federal education funding by more than 90%. The Democratic Party limited the bloodletting to about 50%, but this forever monetized the culture of U.S. educational institutions. So ask yourself this. If we really care about whose interests are we serving, and this is to all the professors, of which I've been an instructor, professor in colleges for a long time. When was the last time you all got together and decided to have a general protest, a general strike, at your universities and colleges until all student debt is forgiven. Wouldn't that then show that you were more than just an intellectual theory, that you were a pragmatic person willing to step out of existential behavior and into the real world? Put yourself on the line, put your career on the line, put your salary on the line for those who will be indebted, the new debt slaves, indentured to the federal government, which owns 40% of that student debt, and to the private institutions, where compounding interest will mean that a student graduating today may not pay off their debt for 20 to 30 years. And it was Joe Biden who was one of the signatories to keep them from being able to file bankruptcy and get out of that. So why don't you stop talking and why don't you do something to show that you're a real person? Otherwise, as Chris Hedges said, it's just talk, talk, talk. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.